Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we learn how Matthew Sweet writes songs.
And it all starts with a big hunk of clay.
It is day two of our
Matthew
Sweet adventure.
Uh-huh. This was a wonderful time, Jim. It was really, really great. Thank you for setting it all up, and thanks to Matthew very much for giving us the time. He was really, really nice. Sat backstage, introduced us to another musician who was playing that night who we may talk to in the future, which would be great.
Okay, so we're trying to work that out.
Yep.
That's all we're going to let people know,
yep.
Right? Okay. no, but, you know, it was so much fun. Matthew Sweet was great, and my wife, Katie, she came out and met us there at the show.
Yes,
It was funny because it was kind of like a touch and go situation whether she was going to be able to make it or not. But she's she did not want to miss this show.
Right.
And for her to come to any show on a work night,
that's a big deal.
That's a big deal. She does not like to do that.
Nope.
So she had to come down to see Matthew Sweet. And we watched the show, and her only disappointment in the show had nothing to do with Matthew Sweet or the performance itself. The only disappointment was, it was her first time at the Birchmere.
Yes.
And the Birchmere is a seated venue.
It is.
They have tables there. And she was like, I want to be like up by the stage, like dancing, you know? So we were kind of farther back, and she did it, especially toward the end when he was playing stuff like Sick of Myself or, or I've Been Waiting or things like that. She got up and danced.
Yeah.
Like right at the table.
Yeah.
So
beautiful.
Yeah. It was great. But anyway, so the show ends, and then I already had sort of like planted this bug in Matthew Sweet's ear when you and I did the interview that maybe after the show, my wife Katie could just come back and
say
hi. So we did that. We went backstage. She had no idea we were going to do that.
Wonderful.
She was so excited. She got like very nervous, like almost immediately, and didn't know what to say. And then she was like, like one of those deals. And then, but then the funniest thing I think that she said was, I'm paraphrasing here. I can't remember exactly what she said, but she's like looking right at me. She goes, "You're the guy who like was on the mixtapes that my husband made for me when we were dating."
That's beautiful.
You know, so that was great. So
that's fantastic.
It was really fun.
Yeah.
He was very, very nice. And
what a nice guy.
Was very appreciative of, you know, how much she was just sort of in awe.
Yeah.
And thought it was she was being very sweet. So, and then I kind of had to pry her away. I was sort of like, okay,
let's
leave the man alone.
Yeah. He needs to wind down.
Yeah.
So that's great.
It was fun. All right. So let's get back to the interview.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I can't wait.
One thing you have adopted is file sharing, right? So you're trading tracks back and forth with people who are not even in the studio with you.
That's right. And that's a fantastic thing.
Yeah, that's
That's really
cool.
Great. And that's why I knew, you know, my wife and I lived in Los Angeles for a little over 20 years, and we moved back to Nebraska, to Omaha, about 3 years ago. And it's one of the, and we thought about going all kinds of crazy places, to Hawaii or the way Northern California coast, but they were all really far from an airport or anyone we knew.
Yeah.
You know, but the reason we could think of all those places is because now, for a person like me, it kind of doesn't matter where I am. You know, I can do work with people anywhere, and I don't even have to physically be there, really. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the fun things about Tomorrow Forever and making it, were the people on the coast that sort of played guitar for me on it. We made basic tracks with two guitars and drums with Paul Chastain and Rick Mank and I. And that's always how I've made records. I'll sort of get a drum track and then I'll play bass and guitars on it and stuff. But I've never really made many records where it was everybody in a room. Some stuff on In Reverse is that way. But even so, take the records I've made with Susanna Hoffs.
Yeah.
When we made the first record, she came over to my house all the time. By the end of that record, I helped her set up stuff at her house. We made the second record. We kind of did some at each place. And then the third one, the 80s one, we just sent it back and forth over really? The internet because the technology got easy to send large files, you know. And that was fun, too, because she'd send me background vocals and I didn't know what they were going to be. And they'd be like some amazing thing, you know. And it was the same way with making my record. And I would just say to people, do whatever you hear. You know, I had very little instruction for anybody, and it was always good. It was like, I was always happy because it was like exciting every time.
That's great to hear, but there's part of me that's surprised by this because I always picture you as being like a Phil Spector or a Brian Wilson in the studio and very much in control of like everything that gets laid down.
Well, I mean, I am in the sense that I play a lot of the instruments myself. I've never been a person that really tells people what to do a lot. The times I tried to do it, even early on, like when we were working on Girlfriend, like I would try to teach, I would have a little head part that I did on the demo that was a leady bit, but just kind of a melodic pattern or something. Evangeline's a good example of this, the kind of thing was something I played on the demo. But then when we were in the studio, rather than make Richard Lloyd learn my little lick, you know, which just wasn't the easiest thing to do, I found every time I tried it, it was like kind of frustrating. I should just play the lick, sort of, you know. And so, like, for instance, on on Evangeline, he would play his leads and then I would take the same guitar through the same amp and play my little parts, you know, and stuff.
Yeah.
I find with any musician, it's when it's uptight in the studio, it's bad for the music.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
When it's easygoing in the studio, it's great for the music. The more people aren't worrying and thinking and trying, the better vibe kind of comes out of it. Yeah. So that's why I think it works so well sending things to people, because for the most part, they first of all can record in their house or apartment or whatever these days. So they can really just do what they feel without feeling on the spot kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm. Where do the lyrics come in your songs, Matthew? At what point?
It's a mixture of stuff. Sometimes I have some words with the original melody. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes I don't, it's just the melody. But then when I'm getting into a mode of kind of writing songs, I will write down little phrases and titles and things that kind of pop in my head. Yeah. So I might have a bunch of melodic ideas and then I'll look through a list and kind of go, hey, this sounds kind of catchy with it. It would sort of fit in that melody. Sometimes they'll come from like a little sort of, notebook concept sort of ideas. I mean, obviously on my phone and notes or whatever these days, but it just depends.
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes I write them, you know, right while I'm working. I don't have them until right when I work on recording the mm-hmm. song.
There's a line, and forgive me if I don't get these exactly right, on the new record, I Am Alive Again. I am from the future.
Oh.
from the future.
Yeah. What was there a particular inspiration behind?
Well, I really like time travel. I've always been kind of I love, you know, the Time Machine, the classic novel, and the old movies of it. And time has been a big. Time's the problem. We only have so much of it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a fundamental problem. And I think I tend to kind of go back to it and ruminate on it and think about going both directions in it, you know, and what it would be like or what, how things sometimes feel like that, you know. And in that song, he says, I'm from the future, coming back to view the time that's holding you. Like, thinking about different times separately, where you're coming at something from a completely alien place. And I get in this sort of mode of thinking from sort of physics and ideas that are going on, you know, about multiple universes. It kind of touches on that and some other songs on the record on Entangled, which is named after entanglement. But Entangled really is more about multiple universes than it is entanglement itself. But I use the title Entangled. But I don't know. I'm a little bit of a physics nerd.
Interesting.
And to me, the universe and space, that's, you know, the greatest question sort of for our little minds. And it's something I just kind of keep track of a little bit. You know, one of the great things with the internet, you can go and take courses in physics at, you know, MIT and stuff with for free, just monitoring these classes, or auditing rather.
Okay, we're interrupt this interview for just a quick little promo
break,
and we'll be right back. Patrick, you're a fan of the Beatles, right?
Yeah, I love the Beatles.
You know, sometime late in the band's career, they started their own record label.
Yeah,
right?
Apple Records.
Apple Records,
I remember.
Right? Yeah. Now they've started a thing called Apple Podcasts.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes.
I didn't know those guys were still together.
Yeah, so if you go to... Yeah, so if you go to what used to be called iTunes, it's now called Apple Podcasts.
Oh, that's awesome.
You can find all kinds of cool content there, and it's all blessed by Sir Paul McCartney and Ringo. And one of the things that they really like, I'm told, is
LSD
and Rock in the Suburbs.
Right.
And when you go to Apple Podcasts, as it's now called, you should rate Rock in the Suburbs. Give us a number of stars that you think is appropriate.
Yep. Yeah.
And also write a little review.
Yeah. You know, take a few minutes. Write your response to A Day in the Life, or just talk about how you like our podcast.
That's right. And it comes to you every day of your life,
right?
Which is nice. And you can see the reviews that Paul and Ringo have left for us. And then you should do the same. Thanks. Okay. So one other thing about songwriting. In the interviews we've done, Patrick and I will often ask songwriting questions, but I don't think we've ever asked anyone this. And I think this is perfect for Matthew here. How do you write a melody?
You know, it's a mysterious thing. I don't really know. It comes from if I get in a certain state of mind, I just hear it, you know, or sometimes I'll hear them when I'm randomly somewhere else or in the shower or something. And I'm always trying to get those little bits down before I forget them. Then I also feel like it wouldn't matter how many I ever forgot, because I could make up ideas all day long, every day, you know. and because of that, I think early in my career, I had a weird feeling about what I did. It almost felt like I did so little, you know, like I almost don't do anything at all, you know, to make a record. And what popped in my head when you asked the question was making pottery really reminds me of the place where music comes from is very similar to getting into sort of a Zen state when you're throwing pottery on a wheel. Hmm. And I would find that I can't ever remember it. It's like, so I would, the crazy thing with making pottery is I would make the pot and then whatever, decorate it and finish glazing it. And then really soon after, I couldn't remember how I ever made it.
Really?
I'd look at it and go, how did I throw that?
That's,
you know, like,
so
what? I just, it seems so foreign to me. Like, I could never do that, like, now.
Yeah.
And music is the same way to me. Like, after a little while, I have no idea how I did it. You know, it's not technical in that way. It's really by feel. It's very undefined, kind of murky place, you know, of just kind of forgetting everything, you know.
So along those same lines, I mean, I think a lot of your records sound, have sort of a timeless sound to them, like they could be from any era. What was it about the 90s that just sort of worked?
You need to be back in the arms of a good friend. And I need to be back in the arms of a girlfriend.
It was a confluence of, you know, first having people that tried to help me and get my records to happen, you know, was amazing, and getting radio support. I think that it was a very unique time in terms of radio and in terms of a whole new movement of kind of indie music. And I think of REM as a really good example of sort of, you would, I really liked REM when I was in high school, and I met those guys when they first played in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I got excited when, like, they got in the top 10 in the back of Rolling Stone in the college radio chart, you know. And there came this time when things from college radio started crossing over into the mainstream. And then this whole realm of radio was born that was, you know, commercial alternative radio. Right. Mm-hmm. And at that point in the beginning, there really was a wide range of things. And so it allowed for me, just one guy, to still exist at a time that was about bands so much, you know. From, you know, Nirvana and REM, all these, everybody was bands, you know. It was unusual to be just some guy, you know. It's, I always felt so lame, you know. it would be better. And some people did it great where they, you know, make up a band name, but it's really just the guy.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably more what I would have done. But when I signed with Columbia when I was about 20, I guess 21 or so, they said, you know, we think you should use your real name and be a solo artist. And that was horrifying to me, but I took on the challenge of trying to just figure out, okay, who am I as just some guy that makes music?
Yeah.
You know? It's funny you mentioned Nirvana and REM, because we did a show once where we talked about our, what we think were the best years in music. Mm-hmm. And my pick was 1991.
Yeah.
And the four albums that we talked about were Out of Time, Nevermind, Bandwagon-esque, Teenage Fan Club.
Oh, yeah.
And Girlfriend.
We love Teenage Fan Club. And, you know, there's a connection because Rick Mank and Paul Chastain from Velvet Crush, who play with me still, we were all great friends then. And they knew about Teenage Fan Club when they were really indie, like before they even had that record come out over here. And we went to see them play in New York. And when we toured over in England, we would... we went and visited them when we were in Scotland, and So that we did have a real affinity to Teenage Fan Club. It's funny.
Both, you know, you guys very similar, I think, in terms of your influences and the kind of music you were doing.
Yeah, they just were so cool, you know. And again, they were a band. So they were like these guys, but they were like cool because they were a band and they sort of all dressed cool. And it was like, made me dismayed always when I saw people like that.
Okay, so we still have another part. And
I can't wait.
Well, here's why you can't wait. I'm going to tell you why specifically. You may not know this. It may just come to you like a melody, but you don't know this. But the listeners are going to be very excited about this.
They are.
Because part three, first of all, we took listener questions that we fielded from the social media. Asked Matthew's listener questions. Yeah. So some of you out there will hear your names.
And have your question
answered. And then also, he talks quite a bit about the covers albums he did with Susanna Hoffs.
You're gonna love that.
And I can tell you, just based on the little, you know, kind of social media sampling that we got when we put the call out, people really love those records.
Yeah, they really, really do. Yeah. Very enduring fan base for those things.
Yes. So you'll want to listen to that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the way you listen to that is you just listen to the show, right?
You subscribe to the show, it comes on your phone, you play it every day.
Every day. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Audioboom, or other podcast platforms.
Yep.
You can also find the show and other fun stuff at our website, which is suburbspod.com. You can email us, rock@suburbspod.com.
Please can
call our Suburban Party line with the catchy jingle that I wrote, and we did file sharing to record the voice of Jody Manross. And Randall Brown helped us out with that. And it was an amazing thing that you can do with technology, as Matthew Sweet mentioned. And here's the jingle.
If you're glad or sad or high, call the Suburban Party line.
And the number is 612-440-1984. And we love that jingle. We will never stop using that jingle. But, you know, maybe there's another part of the show, or maybe for the Suburban Party line, we could, you know, maybe have an alternate jingle or something like that.
Yeah.
And if Matthew Sweet and Susanna Hoffs maybe wanted to record the jingle for us.
If they wanted to record it and include the phone number, we'd really appreciate it.
No, here's the thing. Here's what we need.
Okay.
Matthew.
Susanna.
Yes. You guys do covers, right? You can cover the jingle.
Ah, that's perfect. And they can add in a little.
Yes. Add in the phone number. Yes. Because it's not in there.
All right. Just cover our song.
All right. Do that. That's it. That's all.
That's it. All.
Where was I now? I think that's about it.
That's about it.
And I mentioned the email, right?
You did. Suburbspod.com and rock@suburbspod.com. Yes. And people are, I think, chomping at the bit for tomorrow.
Yes.
So that's going to be great.
We cannot delay. We have to get right to that. Yep. So, all right. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
I don't remember how I got into talking about this. You might have to guide me back to...